You're listening to a day1.fm show.
We actually got a customer straight away, and that was crazy because I never expected. Well, I was really naive, much more naive than now, and I thought that that would be that easy all the way. He said, "So what have you done with this money?" I said, "Oh, we've made mining equipment." And he went even whiter. And then he said, "Where is it?" I think he wanted to go and get it. I said, "Oh, it's in South America." And he just about had a heart attack. I mean, we obviously more than 10x'd during that period, and we probably 100x was a possible outcome because we had New Zealand government linkages, and then by that stage we'd sold to the likes of the IMF and other big brands. It just made it super easy for us to be the established player.
Welcome back to Diaspora.nz, where we're on a mission to seek out and profile the hidden gems, the best founders, operators, researchers, and emerging leaders of the great Kiwi expat community. Today, we're chatting with Clint Van Marwijk, and this one's a little bit different. Clint's an engineer by training and a founder in two very different industries. Simultaneously, he built SaferMe, which was one of the key pieces of infrastructure behind COVID contact tracing initiatives around the world, mostly focused on large companies that operate essential services, but selling a traditional enterprise SaaS business model. Separately and simultaneously, he's the co-founder and director at Zelandes, which is a leading global technology provider to the upstream lithium brine industry. Lithium you'll recognize from basically any modern device with a battery, from iPhones to EVs. The world can't get enough of it, and it's Clint's technology which is unlocking new and environmentally friendly sources. Today, Clint lives in Austin in Texas, but he travels prolifically, including a lot of time in Europe and South America. This episode goes down some serious rabbit holes, so if you're into geeking out on niche software and geological mineral extraction, let's go get stuck in. Clint, fantastic to have you on the Diaspora.nz pod. This feels like a little bit of a coming back to my early days. I remember we bumped into each other in Wellington, and must have been 2012 or 13. You were building a business called Thunder Maps, and you were introduced to me there. I think it was JD Trask, Xing Li. So shout out to them for the intro in the distant past, but it's so good to reconnect. Give me a quick download on where you're at today. We're going to go back in time and trace some of the story to how you got there, but just give us a snapshot. What's the elevator pitch?
Right now, I'm very interested in lithium. So I've been running a lithium brine company for 7 or 8 years now, which is right in the center of the energy transition. So lithium, obviously, a source into lithium ion batteries, and it's spread across Argentina, Chile, Bolivia, Australia, and the United States.
So we know a lot about lithium from everybody listening to this. We'll be doing so on a device that's probably powered by a battery, maybe driving a car. That's got one inside as well. You're a very specific part of that supply chain. I'm dying to learn how you got into that particular space and to that particular business. Take us back a little bit further, though, because I think you're still also involved in SaferMe.
Correct, yeah. So that's a business that provides proactive warnings to try to stop people hurting themselves at work. So that business is still running. It's your typical enterprise SaaS product. So it serves small, medium enterprise businesses across Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. That business has been running for about a decade, I would say, and went through a massive growth stretch during COVID and then tailed off a bit after that.
Take us back even further, because there's two stories that at first glance don't seem terribly intertwined. How did SaferMe sort of come to be? Let's make a start with that one.
Well, at the time, the very genesis of it, I was looking at data sets in the financial industry and doing segmentation at entry, which is just where you predict how rich someone is when they come into your investment fund, and then try and give them different services, basically, and different amounts of attention depending on how much money they have.
Yep.
And a lot of those data sets were freely available. You'd probably be aware of the likes of Experian data sets and others, which classify you into a type of person and would tell me your net worth and how much credit card debt you have and things like that. Obviously, these data sets are bought and used commercially. And then on top of that, I was layering other freely available data sets, which I found really useful for the job, but was somewhat dystopian at the time. And the interesting thing to me was that there was other data, dangerous data. So the other end of the spectrum from happiness, obviously, is death. Mm. So there's other dangerous data just kind of sitting there not being used. So I experimented with that at the time with a developer outside work. We actually got a customer straight away, and that was crazy because I never expected. Well, I was really naive, much more naive than now, and I thought that that would be that easy all the way. And if that never happened, I wouldn't have left and started it and pushed on it. But we did get one straight away and built and built and built. And it's been an interesting learning experience. That business itself has subsidiaries in the US, Australia,
to recap that, you're sitting basically playing with financial data for a day job, helping to qualify leads coming to an investment fund, which sounds like a highly productive activity. On the side of that, you notice, is this where the hazard information comes in? Because it's peer-to-peer data. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. It's right at the start of all that. An interesting market to get into, and you learn a lot about B2B SaaS and enterprise sales and all the lessons that a New Zealand farming engineer wouldn't typically know when they start business. So it was a bit of a ride.
It feels like a really tricky one from a sort of a chicken and egg perspective. The data set's not as valuable until you have a lot of it, but there's not an incentive for a lot of people to start using it until the value's there for them. Does that sound right? And how did you solve that?
There's lots of machine-based data that's freely available. I mean, lightning is a great example. 98% of worldwide lightning strikes are mapped in real time with surprising accuracy. So that's valuable to roofers, scaffolders, certain individuals that don't want to die of lightning strike, which for some people is actually a genuine risk. That's one of the best data sets in the world, mind you, because it's universally covered around the world. And you don't have to kind of put it together in a patchwork type fashion, which you do in other jurisdictions with different data sets. What's interesting with some hazard data is that the same people that are interested in lightning are interested in, you know, hazards at a work site that they're entering for the first time, which might be a human inputted data set. So you can patch it together. The interesting thing, though, is the sales process of that and how you really push that out and distribute that product. So it's like everything, you go in thinking about the product and you finish thinking about the distribution and inside the safety market, which is what you're selling into when you're doing enterprise SaaS. For that type of product, it's a distribution challenge.
What did you have to prove to yourself before you'd quit the day job to go all in on this? Did you have to see a certain amount of traction or sales or something?
Well, I'd been made a limited partner. I was on the limited partner track and the business that I was in got sold. So I had to stay for a year. The business I was in was actually a KiwiSaver firm, which is like a superannuation scheme in Australia or like a 401k in the US. So New Zealand at that time was bringing out a new superannuation system. And I went and tried to find someone that was building that before it came out. And that business did really well and grew. And I got a small piece of that and I had some cash. And so in many ways, I had that freedom and I didn't have to take the risk. You know, I didn't have kids or something that made it really hard to take that risk because I kind of had a bit of cash in my pocket.
But you could have kicked back at the beach and said, no, I'm going to go and chew some glass and try to build a company in a notoriously difficult space. I love these early stories because I think a lot of the folks listening to this, a lot of the feedback I've had is looking particularly into the expat community for inspiration. Someone's sitting there, they've got an itch they want to scratch, or a company they want to build, and they haven't taken the leap. So I'm always curious, even in those early days, and I know you've got another founding story to come shortly as well with Zealanders, but trace us through the journey, your early days, obviously pre-pandemic, there was selling into construction and selling into government. And there must have been, what was the first moment that you saw sort of the pandemic on the horizon and thought like, you know, oh shit, this could be a problem, but also, oh shit, this could be an opportunity. What was the mindset at that point?
We actually had people using the product for contact tracing before it was even really a name that people knew what contact tracing was.
What were they contact tracing if it was pre-pandemic?
Well, in the early stages of the pandemic, like in the very early days of it. And because the system was already set up to track the location of hazards, and including the location of people, which are hazards on a work site, we already had the infrastructure built in the system. It isn't particularly easy to background track users on apps. Like, there's a whole bunch of systems that Apple and Google put in place to slow you down there. But we had some, not so much hacks, but methods to keep the system running more than it otherwise would. So we had a relatively useful system there. We started picking up customers pretty early on. And then we got actually a grant out of the New Zealand government to build a business-focused contact tracing system. And because we already had this idea called the safety bubble, which is like a little virtual geofence that follows the user around, we kind of connected that together, did some marketing, and we got bought a lot in the US. So the product itself sold mostly to US corporations. Yeah. And contact tracing as a concept works actually really quite well when automated contact tracing, I should say. So the typical contact tracing is actually a phone a phone-based system with lots of people in a phone bank. That's what the government doing. It breaks down really quickly if you're not just doing ring fencing. But
when you say that, that was the app that millions of New Zealanders had installed. That was the phone-based one you're talking about. And your system, if I recall, was a card. Was it a Bluetooth-enabled card or something along those lines, a piece of hardware?
Yeah, we ended up commercializing. So we went through a number of iterations of that product and obviously reinvested a bunch of funds from clients and made it a real decent amount of money. But the biggest seller was the contact tracing card or the COVID card, which we commercialized into mostly the United States, but also Australia and the UK. And it works really well when you've got a confined group of people so that you don't have to shut down. So particularly mines, food preparation, places that if you shut that mine down, it costs you tens of millions of dollars per day type thing. So that it just doesn't make any sense. So to be able to identify four people that need to stay home in 5 seconds. It was a crazily hot market. Unfortunately, in a way, it was almost too hot. So we had a working product, but in software, you get knocked off and copied so many times. It's interesting how many times our little business got copied and knocked off. But we did relatively well and scaled up through that and kept a number of those customers after the pandemic, but you know, very, very few in comparison to the bulk of them.
And that was the shift. That was what I believe drove the shift to Austin as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been going back and forth to the US. My first job was straight after my engineering degree in Colorado. I've always been sort of fascinated by how optimistic they are, ambitious as well, I would say, as a rule. I'm like that introvert surrounded by extrovert. I like that input. And yeah, it's just a good place to do business. So I like the place. And because of the E2 visa system, I can easily go back and forward. And it's nice.
I've got two questions I want to go on before moving on, because I'm just fascinated. At this point in time, you've got the grant from the New Zealand government. You've got the international interest coming in. You said you scaled up reasonably well, but I'm just curious about, you know, with the wisdom of hindsight, could you have moved faster? Was there some sort of blocker, some moment you could have seized this opportunity and built even more than you're able to?
Definitely. I mean, we've done this backwards looking exercise a number of times. If we could execute perfectly, I think we could have 10 to 20x the result. There were some limitations, in particular PR at the right time. That was one of the missing components. We did try and correct that to a degree in the second year of the pandemic, but there were some natural limitations with components. There's 22 components inside the little card that we had. And at one stage, we were buying every single one of these components that existed in the world. there was just none left, and people were hoarding them. So it was relatively difficult to get hold of the electronics at the time. But we did have to pay through the nose to get them all, but we did. So there were some natural limitations on growth there. Mm. But yeah, I mean, we obviously more than 10x'd during that period, and we probably 100x was a possible outcome.
Yeah. I wonder if that translates into sort of a general principle. If you're in a very hot space with a lot of fast followers, people who are knocking you off, ripping you off, the investing in PR or building the brand or becoming the obvious thought leader would be a strategy you could use.
Yeah, I definitely would say that that's true. We did have the big brands coming to us. So it was a kind of crazy thing where at one stage I was on LinkedIn, as you do, and someone sent me one of those typical LinkedIn spam notes. I checked it. I was like, who is this? They actually looks like someone. It was the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, randomly DMing me on LinkedIn. Never met this person. So you genuinely had market pull. Yeah. And, you know, we set up a meeting and closed that deal inside, I think it was 14 days. The actual close rate was really quick as well. So you're talking about 21-day close rate start to finish.
When you're talking about big Fortune 500s and governments, I mean, it's insanely fast as well.
Yes. Yeah. So they all had special teams that they set up to buy things. So it was obviously cutting around their normal system. And then because we had New Zealand government linkages, and then by that stage we'd sold to the likes of the IMF and other big brands, it just made it super easy for us to be the established player.
You've obviously had a background engineering. You've built a software company which was used on safety, in particular on mines. How did the Zealanders journey start?
Yeah, I mean, lithium's obviously a really important substance for the energy transition, so that it's kind of naturally attractive.
Tell me why. I'm curious about, I mean, there's lots of different battery technologies. Lithium is the one a lot of people talk about, certainly the one that's most popular in every device. What is it about lithium?
Yeah, I mean, some of it's a misnomer. Because lithium is only one component in the battery, but it is a significant component. So the rule of thumb to use is there's about 800 grams or 0.8 of a kg of lithium carbonate equivalent per kilowatt hour in a car. So if you've got like a 100 kilowatt hour battery pack, you'd have roughly 80 kgs of LCE equivalent. LCE is just lithium carbonate, which is one of the main trading components once it leaves a mine.
Why Zealanders? How did you get started?
Obviously, I was a mechanical engineer. I went into finance, and a lot of my mechanical engineering friends went and worked for big oil companies or mines or building things, real things in the real world. And I always kept in touch with them, especially the entrepreneurial ones. And one of my friends who I was in university with married Oblivion. And he previously worked in the oil and gas market and knew a lot about the technologies that were built in that market. And it just so happens that the oil and gas market spends tens of billions of dollars on R&D and really heavily invests in the different sensors, tools, and techniques to get oil out of the ground. And although those tools aren't directly transferable, they can be altered or made smaller, changed so that they work in a highly salty, corrosive environment. And it was kind of obvious that all of these low-hanging fruit were sitting there, and the lithium brine market was the lowest cost source of this new material. No one was using oil and gas techniques, literally no one.
So at this point, I mean, around a decade ago, lithium was certainly on the radar as a battery technology. EVs weren't quite as obvious as they are today. I understand, I mean, the prominent sources of lithium were mined out of rock, out of the earth directly. And this does feel like there's a little bit of a parallel to, say, the shale gas movement, which you might be referencing. And there's sort of a higher difficulty of extraction, but once you develop the technology to unlock it, it's a lower cost. Does that sound right?
Lithium traditionally was a byproduct and was a specialty chemical. So the base load before lithium-ion batteries, which were commercialized in roughly 1991, Sony did that, and actually originally invented by ExxonMobil, the oil company, kind of.
All right. Ironic.
So I think that was in the 70s, and it was sort of carried through for a while by a couple of individuals who never made any money out of the lithium-ion batteries. And then Sony picked it up, commercialized it, and I think they used it for camcorders, something like that. So it was originally quite a niche even then, and there's roughly 150,000 tons of baseload demand without the modern battery demand when it comes to lithium. Most of that was a byproduct. There were very few mines that were kind of actively targeting lithium. And then as the growth kind of happened, everyone could see the writing on the wall. Some people could see the writing on the wall with EVs. You can start painting a relatively clear picture that lithium's going to move from a specialty chemical to a commodity. And that doesn't happen very often. So what I mean is something like copper is a well-known commodity. You know, every person in the world that's in a rich country has roughly 250 kgs of copper to their name. Steel is another one. So you there would have, or anyone really listening to this in Australia, New Zealand, UK, US, would have roughly 15 tons of steel serving them.
Yep.
And lithium is going through that similar transition. So right now, well, that's my opinion. So that's the real bull case for lithium, is that, so backing up a little bit more to try and explain, with something like steel, if you're in a poor country, you might only have like half a ton serving you, or copper, it might only be 60 kgs. And then as your country gets richer, you start intensifying and having more steel, more copper in circulation, actually doing the job for you. It's in the background, like you don't even, no matter how much organic food you eat, or no matter how much you replace your plastic bags with non-plastic bags at the supermarket, you've still got that copper and steel out there doing its job. When you move on as a person and, you know, die, someone else will take your place and pick up that, and it gets recycled and so on. So the good news is you don't keep accumulating more and more steel for you. Mm. Most of it, steel in particular, is really well recycled. copper's the same, aluminium's the same, there are many like this. And I think that's what's happening with lithium, where you can build a bull case that somewhere around 100 kgs LCE equivalent per modern human. And right yep. now, I think it's sitting somewhere around less than a gram per person. So it's like a 100,000-fold increase in lithium intensity is required.
Yeah. How many, I'm trying to figure out how many orders of magnitude that is. So you're looking at, on a population level, Western or developed economies first just need to have a huge amount more lithium. This is going to come from somewhere. Is brine the, you know, one of, is it the leading source of it? Why is that the one that you chose to focus on?
Yeah, it's the cheapest. So in resources, what matters is, fundamentally what matters is how much resources it takes to get the resource. I know that sounds a bit convoluted, but if you take an example like something like the Canadian oil sands, the reason it's expensive is you need more energy to get the oil in the first place. Saudi Arabian oil, everyone would know, is somewhat cheaper. It's because you need less energy to get it. But the same is true with most resources, and lithium's no exception. So if something is cheaper, it's usually because it requires less resources to get it. Now, there are other components that matter, you know, environmental standards and, you know, the basic things that everyone needs to actually do, table stakes. Vast majority of the cost of the resource is the resource use itself. So when you look at lithium, the lowest cost curve production is typically from brine. There are other sources of lithium, in particular spodumene, famously out of Western Australia. It's a hard rock-based product and is much faster to produce. So you can bring it to production inside, say, a 3 to 6 year period if you're doing things properly. Whereas brine could take anywhere up to 10 to sort of 12 years.
Talk us through that production curve, because I'm curious. I mean, my rough understanding is you've got reservoirs of brine, mostly underground. I'd be curious, I mean, how do you identify where to drill to find them in the first place? You're then pumping the brine to the surface and I believe evaporating it in very large pools, which would have some degree of environmental impact in the areas and the ecosystems that they are in. Step us through sort of that initial exploration through surfacing the brine stage. And then I'd love to even go a couple of layers deeper from there.
Yeah, I mean, so we sell a number of products, and when we pick what we sell, we try to find things that have no competition. So we've got a team that goes out there and helps the explorer figure out what to do. So literally designs their drilling program. And when you're doing the early exploration, you'll advise them on where to, literally where to drill just to see if there's any lithium.
Who are the explorers? Is this sort of a free market entrepreneurial endeavor, or are they more government?
There's a real range. It's moving up into better balance sheets slowly over time. But it, usually the traditional path is there's listed explorers in Australia or Canada. That's where the bulk of them are, but they may well be individuals. They might be an offshoot of an OEM or someone downstream, is what it's called. So we're in the upstream, which is like the very beginning of the process. Roughly 15 to 20 years later, it gets turned into a battery. So our end of the system is, you know, really at the energy and materials end of the system, which I think doesn't get enough attention at all by engineering talent or even financing, I'd say.
It does strike me that 15 to 20 years is a hell of a long time to finance a venture before you see cash flow from it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, usually it changes hands. So the land may well change hands from the explorer, who will sell it to someone in the middle, and then they'll develop it slightly, and then they'll get bought out. So usually there's multiple transactions that will happen across that asset through time. So in a way, our strategy is to serve the asset. So when we look at our business, we always think, okay, where are the very best lithium assets in the world? How do we serve that asset? Because once we are serving it, we understand it, we've logged it, we've got all the data on it, then we can serve the next client as soon as it's sold, and we can just keep helping them. If we serve the client and not the asset, then you end up chasing things that can't pay you money because eventually the client will run out of money if it's not a good asset. So we put a lot of effort into trying to figure out where the good assets are.
Where are the good assets? You're talking about South America, the lithium triangle, I believe, is somewhat Argentina, Bolivia, Chile.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking resources, again, you define a good asset by being low on the cost curve. So that means it's far away from the marginal cost of supply, which typically is the price of any given commodity. So you're looking for things that produce cheaply once they're in production, which in the lithium world at this stage means brine assets that are close to surface. And the reasons the surface matters is when water's hot. As water gets deeper, it gets hotter. And as water gets hotter, as you remember from chemistry, it dissolves things. And if that water dissolves sand, which it does when it's really deep, when it comes up to surface, the sand comes out, precipitates out, gets in all your pipes, clogs everything up, makes it really expensive to process. So that's one of the key ways you can kind of define what good looks like. Another one, obviously, is grade. So if you look at something like lithium, it's actually very plentiful. So the great news for the world is there's a lot of, and whilst it's a key cost in building electric cars and energy storage and so on, if we can really keep the cost low, keep the supply high, we're going to make that transition pretty effectively, I think. But yes, we still need to get enough of it and get enough of it quickly because the world, you know, the world really needs it.
This is great. To recap, you are partnering with the assets. The assets are ideally as shallow as possible, as high grade as possible, reservoirs. What does it mean to partner with an asset? You are just making yourself available as a service provider to all of the explorers who are coming along. Some of them will come in, they'll do their work, they might sell out, they might go bust, but you're always there providing services to the next ones as they come up.
Correct. So we've got a number of different product lines, including tools and sensors that we use at different stages, and we sell them into the client. So some of our products, I mean, I think we've got something like 75, 80% of the market, and then some of them we only have like 10 or 15%. Wow. For the one that we're pushing towards, we're hoping to get somewhere around the 5 to 10% of the whole market, but that's the really large, you know, big hairy goal project. But yeah, the process of lithium is a long one because you have to find it, then you have to prove that it's economic. There's a number of ways that projects are financed. And so the client needs to prove in various steps, a bit like, you know, your typical VC process where you actually have to prove kind of milestones in order to get that next tranche of money. Because the amount of money that gets invested in these projects in the long run is really quite significant. So you're talking, you know, a $2 billion implementation for a mid-sized project, and a really large project might be sort of $4 to $6 billion.
It strikes me, I mean, you reference as VC as an example, it's actually a subset of that would be almost something like funding a new pharmaceutical to market. You've got a very early R&D stage, discovery, and then you've got a proof of concept stage, and then you've got a, you know, initial animal trial stage, and you've got an initial human trial. And each one of those, you're de-risking. And often you're actually building an asset, and the asset is being sold to somebody else downstream who is more set up to continue developing and financing that. So it's fascinating. So the step after exploration, you've got these explorers who are out there. They've got the brine coming to the surface, and it's a sufficient grade to be economic. What's happening from there?
After that, it splits into two broad types of processing. So arguably the best for the environment is to use the sun and concentrate that lithium brine up using evaporation because the sun is a free energy source. But there's other chemical-based techniques where you can strip the lithium from that brine, then treat that water again. So it's basically a massive water treatment process, which still, you know, we're quite good at. Engineers know how to do this stuff. And then treat that brine so that it's the same as it was when it got taken out, except that the lithium is gone. And then you put that brine back into the reservoir it came from and maintain the sort of water balance of that aquifer. You want to keep the pressure of the aquifer up so that you can keep moving the water through the pores. So if you kind of pull all the water out, basically, you compress down, you'll get sinking of the land. And underneath the earth, what's happening is the little gaps between the rock are closing up. So you want to keep that pressure up and then make sure that you are reinjecting or recycling that brine in the right place so that it's pushing the brine that still has lithium in it towards your production wells. But these techniques are really well known. Reinjection's been happening in oil and gas, often at shallow depths. It's a well-understood engineering technique.
So you've got the evaporation pools, the ever increasingly concentrated liquid that's then separated into a lithium carbonate or something. And is that just the raw material that gets shipped off to Panasonic to wind up in your Tesla?
There's actually multiple steps. The miner often targets a battery-ready product. And in that case, it's bought by the big trading houses. So it might be Mitsubishi, It might be an end buyer themselves that want to control it because they don't have any access to it. It gets shipped off to typically China. The vast majority of refinement of these products happens in China, not the production itself, but the refining. But nowadays, there's more refining pressure to have refining capacity in the US, the Europe, and Asia, Korea, and Japan in particular. So that's the process. And it obviously takes a very long time to do all of that and then get turned into a battery at the end. Spodumene, which is the Australian-based stuff, might come out at 1.2%, 1.5%, if you're lucky, 2%. And then the spodumene itself is only 8% lithium content. So just a massive amount of rock for the actual lithium that's produced. And that's why it's more expensive, because you have to have obviously a lot of trucks, a lot of steel, a lot of oil and gas energy to process that. And then once you've processed the rock, where do the chemicals and byproducts go? That's kind of the two trade-offs. When you're looking at the supply of lithium, there's kind of like a couple of big building blocks of misunderstandings in the general market. People always think, oh, you know, an electric car is worse than a petrol car because you have all these material in the battery. It's so bad. Well, no, all of that's going to get recycled. It's way too valuable. I mean, the battery is the value of the car, pretty much. So the systems for that are all being set up, and it's going to be a massive industry in its own right. People don't understand that this sort of 50% comes from hard rock, 50% brine, and all the intricacies of those trade-offs.
I'm glad, you know, you've gravitated towards lithium because it seemed like an opportunity. It clearly is. Have you ever thought about the minerals, the resource-rich nature of parts of the world closer to home? I'm curious to put yourself back into the New Zealand shoes momentarily. You know, if you were the Minister for Energy, what are the steps you'd be taking to plan for this future that you see coming?
Politics is hard, isn't it? I mean, I think it's easy for us to abstract. It's easy for individuals in the modern world to abstract ourselves away from what we are in the system and not to realize just how dependent we are on resources. But that's the first thing I say. Whether the New Zealand is a solvable political challenge is up for debate. Absolutely, New Zealand should be seeking gas as a comparison to coal, just based off carbon dioxide emissions per unit of energy alone. I mean, that's always shocked me that we would stop using gas and then start using more coal. I mean, what kind of who's the neurodivergent person who thought that was a good idea? I mean, you're literally pumping out twice as much carbon dioxide. I don't know why that's a good idea.
When people are thinking about opportunities within lithium, and I'm curious, when you thought about getting in, how did you were there sources of financing available or venture capital or equivalents to fund these businesses? Obviously, you are a technology and services business that serves the industry. You're not actually out there financing the expeditions and selling the lithium yourself. I'm not sure if you've been tempted to try. How did you get started? And from the capital markets and financing side of things?
Yeah, interestingly, we started initially, I think it was 2017, with an unsecured BNZ bank loan.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And
credit to VNZ for taking a punt on that one.
Yeah. Shout out VNZ. But a little bit of an interesting story there. My bank manager at the time, I had an overdraft for my other business, and he'd known me for a number of years. And I think he was really enthused by the kind of giving back to the world nature of lithium. I sort of explained why lithium mattered. And this is before kind of electric cars became well known as going to be inevitable. But he has backing behind us, and then gave us a loan, unsecured, and then he left. And he handed our account to a new bank manager who had, I think, 65 property portfolios and one business portfolio that was unsecured. And I sat down with him in our first meeting, and he was a little bit white in the face. And he sort of said, well, this is unsecured. You need to give me some security. I was like, no, no, we don't need security. And there's not much you could do about it other than we were just paying him back because we were making plenty of money. But he was panicking. And then he said, so what have you done with this money? I said, oh, we've made mining equipment. And he went even whiter. And then he said, where is it? I think he wanted to go and get it. I said, oh, it's in South America. And he just about had a heart attack. but shout out to BNZ. They backed us in the beginning. We're still with them now, and no, it's good.
Well, they've earned themselves a loyal customer by the sounds of things. Is an industry that you know, if people were getting into today, is there more financing options around? I'm just looking for the entry routes, if you know, that you'd see out there for people to go. And
yeah, there's plenty of opportunity. I would say, like a lot of businesses, distribution is key. Our particular business is deciding not to own assets, and we don't do DLE. So we've kind of segmented off two things we don't do so that we can maintain our independence and serve everybody. So our role as a business is just to share technology between all of the projects and make sure that they've got the best that they can and try and find and invent new things, which is really fun for engineers. So we're constantly looking for new things to distribute or build or sell. I would say that in situ leach mining, which is very similar to what we're doing, that's going to be an expanding field as well. As you know, lots of the best resources at the very top of the Earth's crust have been mined. And if you want to find it and mine it, you have to go deeper and deeper. But what makes that difficult is you really need to do that efficiently. And a lot of the things that we do as Zealanders, I think, could be extended into that market. So in other words, making things much cheaper to do. Using much smaller boreholes. So that's one of the main cost impediments. And I think it's fair to say that engineers themselves are somewhat blind to energy and materials as a sector. I don't know why. I don't think it's a particularly popular area, but it kind of should be. Like it's fundamental, has been forever, will be forever. Yeah, get in there would be my encouragement to entrepreneurs.
What keeps you up at night, specifically from a chemical or you know, future battery storage development perspective? If for example, sodium ion batteries or solid state batteries or an alternative technology came along that superseded lithium, would that be a problem for you? Do you think that's likely? Or what else keeps you up at night?
Yeah, I don't know how likely it is. Keeping lithium cheap enough is important. I think it will be cheap in the long run because there's so much of it, which is a good thing. But in the short term, there's so much demand for new projects and it takes so long to bring them online that that's a real challenge. And the market goes through price cycles. If it goes up too much, literally your Tesla costs you 55 grand instead of 35 grand. Mm. And that 20 grand is really important. Electric cars have just got cheaper than petrol cars now, and they're arguably slightly better. But eventually they're going to be way better and significantly cheaper. So I think the likelihood of lithium being replaced is actually relatively low. I mean, there are kind of almost black swan type things that could happen. Like, what would an AI invent? If I was an AI, the first thing you'd invent would be a high temperature superconductor. And then the second thing you'd invent is a non-chemical battery. And then after that, probably things I don't have the capacity to understand. But
yep.
That might happen, like if anything's going to blow our minds, but how far away is that? 5 years maybe? And then is that possible? I don't know. But it does seem like lithium has some natural benefits to it. Obviously, it's an extremely small atom. It doesn't damage the cathode, so it's really easy to work with, extremely high energy density. So there's a number of reasons why it should be used. And then actually the solid state batteries that are coming seem to use more lithium, not less. If the world changes, will change with it, I guess.
Yep. Non-chemical batteries are an interesting one. What do you have your eyes on in that space as interesting, as most promising that you're following along with, if anything?
Good question. Obviously, solar is tremendously impactful for lithium itself. So what is the end game? You might even have ideas on what that is. I mean, if I had to estimate, I suspect it'd be somewhere between 50 to 60% of grid energy will eventually be made by solar. It just seems
in which
like
case it has to be stored somewhere and then slowly restored overnight and things like that.
Correct. Yeah. So obviously a natural pairing with storage, probably lithium batteries, frankly. And then actually cathode development is something to keep your eye on because we're naturally trying to move away from cobalt. So although people think about energy transition metals as, you know, rare, the truth is not actually that many of them that are used in batteries are rare. They are plentiful, but something like cobalt isn't. And unless we find massive deposits of that, what can we do on the cathode side, which is where typically the expensive part of the battery is other than the lithium. Now, the good news is we are inventing things there. There's a slightly less energy dense version, LFP, which is potentially much, much cheaper. And if we can build a battery for, you know, a battery pack for $3,500 rather than $10,500, it makes all the difference, right? Why has copper changed the world? Why does steel and concrete change the world? It's not because they're cheap necessarily. It's because they're really good value for money. Copper's not a cheap thing. It's sort of $10,000 a ton, roughly. But they're incredibly valuable for that price. And that's the key thing with lithium. If we can keep it cheap enough for long enough, it will become a commodity. And that will change the world in its own right. Obviously, the whole grid-based system will change with it. It's an incredibly interesting thing to watch.
We've gone way down into the weeds, and I've had a lot of fun, and hopefully others have followed along. To bring this into a close, I mean, you're an engineer by origin and by trade. If you were a young engineer listening to this podcast today, looking at what impact they want to have in their career, what words of advice would you have for them? How would you find what you're most passionate about? And how do you blend sort of the entrepreneurial streak that you've clearly had into that career?
Depends on the age of the person. If the person's really young, I'd try and find a fast-growing business and go and work there. Like if you're 20, 21 to 24, roughly, I'd try and find an 8 to 15 person business that clearly has legs and literally bang down their door and work for them for half a decade. If you're older than that and have genuine skill, then I would encourage energy and materials. I think it's got some unneeded blindness to the sector. I mean, and I'm saying that from a position of experience, having worked in finance and also built a SaaS business. And that mistruth in the market can be taken advantage of. I mean, the reason that Zealanders does so well in a way is because there's no competition. And the reason there's no competition in these little products that we build is because there's no money to finance all the startups to build them. Okay. So yeah, go into the real world. I think that's where the opportunity is.
So excited to see our 100,000 fold increase in lithium over the coming decade or two. Certainly going to be doing my bit to drive electric cars and, you know, get off grid and store my solar power. So no, there's a lot of fun. Thank you so much, Clint. We'll wrap it up there.
Thank you, mate.
That's a wrap. Thanks for listening. As a quick reminder, make sure you hit subscribe in your favorite podcast player so you can keep getting stories like this landing in your feed every Friday, power you through those weekend chores. I want to give a quick shout out to the boys at Supermix who do all our editing. Zach and Xavier are Kiwi expats themselves. They're building a thriving business in the heart of New York City. A lot of respect. Not a sponsor, just a happy customer here. Also, for my day job, I'm an entrepreneur in residence and an investor at Blackbird Ventures. We're backing the best Kiwi founders wherever they are in the world. My personal sweet spot is pre-seed and seed. I like to say no check is too early, so drop me a line anytime. That's dbooth@blackbird.vc. We'll look forward to seeing you back next week.